During the summer, I love to keep Fiji water on hand to keep me and my family hydrated and refreshed. It really is sourced from the islands of Fiji. Drop by drop, Fiji water collects in a sustainable ancient aquifer 1,600 miles away from the nearest continent, protected and preserved naturally from external elements. As the water filters through volcanic rock, it collects a unique profile of electrolytes and minerals, resulting in more than double the electrolytes as the other two top premium water bottle brands, giving Fiji water its soft, smooth taste. Unlike some other premium bottled waters, Fiji water's electrolytes are 100% naturally occurring, and this water even has a perfectly balanced pH of 7.7. Fiji water really is Earth's finest water, and since 2022, its 330-milliliter and 500-milliliter bottles have been produced in 100% recycled plastic, so you can feel proud of your choice in bottled water. Get stocked up on Fiji water this summer and visit your local retailer to pick some up today for your next backyard party, beach or pool day, hike, or even your home office. It's not just water, it's Fiji water.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Dress, the History of Fashion, is a production of Dress Media. With over 8 billion people in the world, we all have one thing in common. Every day, we all get dressed.
Welcome to Dress, the History of Fashion, a podcast that explores the who, what, when of why we wear. We are fashion historians and your hosts, Cassidy Zachary
and April Callahan. As you know, today's episode is rather long overdue, especially given the fact that it addresses the needs of a sizable portion of our audience. And until reading the book written by this week's author, I was not entirely aware of just how sizable that segment of our audience is. Or rather, I should say, I wasn't familiar with the exact statistics. Did you know that 26% of Americans live with a disability?
I did not know that.
Yeah, I didn't either. And globally, that number comes in at 15%. So that means about 1 billion of us humans currently living on this planet routinely navigates a world that doesn't always accommodate for disabilities and the specific needs for that individual.
And as we know at the top of each and every episode, the daily act of getting dressed is one thing that binds all of humanity together, regardless of nationality, race, religion, gender, and sexual orientation, and disability. Today, we are so pleased to welcome Dr. Kate Annette Hitchcock to the show to discuss her recently released book, The Intersection of Fashion and Disability, A Historical Analysis.
Kate is a professor emerita of the Wilson College of Textiles at North Carolina State University in Raleigh, North Carolina, and she has also previously taught at East Carolina University, Virginia Tech, and Savannah College of Art and Design. Her research focuses on clothing for health and well-being and the power of design in dressing for disability.
We are so pleased that Kate will join us all this week in a two-part episode, which provides an overview of the historic convergence of fashion, dress, and disability. Kate, thank you for being here and welcome to Dressed.
Kate, thank you so much for joining us on Dressed.
Well, thank you for having me. This is exciting.
Yeah, and I'm really thrilled to talk to you today, as this intersection of fashion and disability has been something on our list of future episodes for far too long. We have made very specific mentions of contemporary initiatives in this realm of design from time to time on the show before. But when I saw your book come out, I got very excited a few months ago because it is this sweeping history of dress, fashion, and disability, and it dates back some 500 years or so. So before we get to that little bit of time traveling, would you introduce yourself to our listeners, maybe share a little bit about your background and also how you came to be working on this topic?
Yeah, so thank you so much for the introduction. And yes, it is intended as a sweeping history. I don't pretend to be an expert in any one area. I'm going to start with your last question first while it's on my mind. The book came to be written because I actually studied this for my PhD dissertation at Virginia Tech, which was way back in the early 2000s. I think I finished my PhD in 2002. And I was lucky enough to have access to a lot of information, brochures, pamphlets, extension booklets that were published during the 60s and 70s. And I did a whole chapter on my dissertation that after I finished, because I had to, my dissertation would have been like 1,000 pages and no one, well, I don't know if anybody read it anyway, but highly unlikely that anybody
would have read it. The perils of academia.
Yeah. my advisor was like, you have to stop now. So I thought, well, I've got all this stuff sitting there and I only managed to get one chapter out in the history and it was just 20th century history. So I thought I need to just get this stuff out there that I already have and make it available to anybody. And so once I started digging, I then thought about, well, I'm going to expand it beyond the 20th century. I wonder if there's history back before the 20th century. And there was, but it was very spotty. The research process was was very hit or miss, to be honest with you, because this is a new topic. And then I ended up back in the 15th century. 16th century as a starting point. So now to answer your real question, I have a degree in initially art history at Manchester University. And my last year, I did a module on history of 18th century costume with the wonderful Jennifer Harris, who's a brilliant textile historian and at times curator of textiles at the Whitworth Art Gallery. So I did some volunteering there. I was able to volunteer at Platt Hall, which is the Gallery of English Costume in Manchester, and a couple of other places, and decided to do a master's in costume history. And I was also very enamored with the US at the time and wanted to come over. I'd watched too many episodes of Starsky and Hutch. Well, I'll just come over to the US and do a master's here. So I came to Michigan State, did that. Was heavily involved in theater as well, and then ended up teaching at the Savannah College of Art and Design in the early 90s in what was the beginning fashion program there, and then decided to come back and get my PhD and ended up at Virginia Tech and sort of fell into the topic. I think I was going to study international trade and economics. And as usual with research, things took a different direction. I had a landlady as a graduate student who was a professor in the College of Architecture. She was also a ceramicist, potter, but she had post-polio syndrome and was in a wheelchair much of the time. And I started making clothes for her. She had a very distinct way of dressing and was very clear about what she wanted, and it had to be professional. And I thought, well, not only is it difficult for people to get dressed with a disability, but then when you step it up a notch and you're a professional woman, you know, that really changes the game in terms of how you want to present yourself. And I still find that what I call working dress or professional working dress is, I think sometimes that's a challenge for those of us who don't have a disability, knowing what to wear. And so I decided to do my dissertation on a sort of a combination of inclusive design and adapting that to the clothing process. Because the universal design was still a fairly new topic at that point. And it was really dedicated to the built environment. So I thought, well, I wonder if you can take those same principles of universal design and use them to design for clothing design for disabilities. Not only that, can you step up the sort of level of the game so that people who are really working and are professionals in their field feel like someone is paying attention to their needs. And so that's basically what I worked on, and worked with 10 really wonderful professional women in and around Blacksburg and Roanoke, and then took it to industry. And that's where things hit a bump, because at the time, the industry professionals who I worked with said, yeah, we can make any of this stuff, but you don't have a market. So I just held on to all of that stuff. I've been teaching at East Carolina and then NC State since 2008. I've been at NC State, and it was lovely to come back to the university that actually initiated universal design at the college. I was in the College of Textiles, Wilson College of Textiles. I retired last summer, but I'm still teaching a few classes. And I retired, and then the book came out. And so I still got my sort of hands on things on a consulting basis, but I'm letting the book run its course, but I've been doing quite a bit of stuff related to that recently.
You released your baby out into the world.
I released the baby. I do want to point out as well, because this is very important, I am not disabled. I don't pretend to be part of that lived experience. I had a very adventurous teenagehood and broke a lot of bones. So I've been temporarily disabled, but I am not. I rely on my contacts and the people I know in the disabled community to share with me their lived experience. But I am not a disabled person.
Always good to point out. So in the book, you have elected to use the term disability quite intentionally, where there are other terms such as differently abled that are also now used commonly. Well, in the past, the usage of handicapped was quite common. So why did you elect to use disability specifically? And how would you like to define that for our purposes here in the podcast today?
Yeah, well, this is another aspect of the book that things do change quite a bit. And so, you know, 5 years down the road, the language that I've used in the book may be looked on as quite archaic. So I have to give a disclaimer to that. But I like to keep things as they are presently defined. And I did a lot of talking to people in the disabled community about this. And a couple of people who I rely on very heavily. And they both agreed that so recently, I'd say in the past 10 or so years, the term person with a disability has been how we've commonly seen people communicate about disability. That has since moved on. And the people I know in the disabled community like to have the word disabled first, which really puts the burden on the environment. So let's say one has a broken leg for a while. The environment is what is disabling one from moving around freely, right? It's not necessarily that you have a broken leg or you have some kind of more permanent issue. My ability to get around is hampered by the environment. My ability to get dressed is hampered by the environment. And so when I use the word disabled at the beginning, it automatically, I'm disabled by something in the environment. I am not disabled as a person. That's not my identity. And so I explain this at length in the first chapter of the book, but that's the reason why I use the wording that I do. And again, it was consultation with people with lived experience to get to that point. And like I said, in 10 years' time, things may have changed. I will say that differently able that you use, again, the idea of making someone different is kind of out of favor at the moment, because let's be honest, we're all on a spectrum. We are all asymmetrical when it comes to clothing. We all have one side of the body bigger than the other. We may have one hip higher than the other. There may be little things that make things not fit. I'm bringing this back to clothing again, and then all the way up to fairly severe aspects of disability. But we're all there at some point. We're all going to get older, and we're going to find that life is more difficult in many aspects. But when we design universally to try and make products more acceptable for a wider range spectrum of people, then that's, I think, when we start thinking about accessibility design with that in mind. So you don't have to adapt or change or improvise or accommodate.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, we've run into this on the show in terms of terminology, because we're now in our 7th season. We are approaching our 500th episode soon. So it's been almost 7 years. But some of the shows that we did when we very first started, those terms no longer apply just 7 years later. So sometimes we get comments from people on that, and we're like, well, that was That was the term. That was like the terminology. That's the primary source language of that time. So it's a very real thing.
It's a good thing. It's good that things evolve and things change. Hopefully, well, I wonder at the moment if things are changing for the better, but generally progress is, it is, it's evolution, right? And things, we expect things to change. If things didn't change, we wouldn't have food to eat.
So let's get back to said baby, I suppose, the book. You write very early on in the book that, quote, this story of the intersection of fashion and disability begins in the mid-16th century. And this is, of course, the era of the Renaissance, a good 200 years prior to the Industrial Revolution. So just reminding our listeners that all clothing at this time was made by hand, right? Even into the early modern period in the 18th century, everything was being made to measure by hand. So could you speak to this in terms of how clothing being produced in this manner related to people with physical disabilities in, you know, this period between the 16th and 18th century? And also to tag on to that idea, how were disabilities viewed at this time in the public sphere?
Well, to go back to the date, I had to start somewhere. And I picked the mid-16th century. There was a French military surgeon by the name of Ambroise Paré, who's sort of generally accepted as the sort of father of assistive devices. He started out developing devices for soldiers who'd been wounded on the battlefield. And at that time, there wasn't a lot of protection. But he invented some amazing prosthetic hands that moved and had cogs and wheels and things. Really, really interesting. And he also invented a corset. And I thought it was really interesting that he mentioned his reason for inventing a corset. And it was basically for young girls. And luckily, there's an English translation of his book that was done in the early 1600s. He said that he had noticed there was a fashion for mothers of urban young girls to constrain the child's body. And it led to all kinds of problems when they grew up, and their backs were misaligned. And so my ears pricked up. And I think we're going to talk about corsets a little bit, but so the corset was sort of the cause and the cure. And of course, what did he do to fix this problem? Well, he invented another corset, and it was especially for girls. And he said, well, this needs to be changed out. It's going to straighten the back. It's going to get rid of all these problems. And basically, this is a societal problem. It's a fashion problem. It doesn't happen in the countryside because people are working and they're using their bodies every day. But there seems to be an urban fashionable society problem. And I thought, well, I'll start there. Now, I do want to say that disability, I did a little bit of digging into ancient Greece and Rome. There is evidence that disability was obviously acknowledged and talked about. I just couldn't find any evidence on the clothing side.
I wonder if, because the majority of clothing at that time was draped and not tailored, if that solved that issue in a lot of ways.
Well, that is one of the points I make in the book. And this goes to your second point, is that from up until the late 19th century, when we started mass producing garments to scale, pretty much everything was made by hand, right? It was a dual thing of the sewing machine and then mass produced patterns and sizing systems. I feel like we somewhat lost the ability to customize clothing because of mass production. So now the great thing is most of us can walk into a store and find something that sort of fits us, like 80, 85% fits us. But there's people among us who don't have that luxury, because industry, in order to make a profit and survive, has to draw the line somewhere about what are the guardrails within which they are going to produce clothing. And it's a few sizes fit all. Operators, when I initially started my research, saying, do you have anything disability? And I'm like, no, I don't think so, because stuff is not, it's not really cataloged that way. There isn't a section in most collections. But some people got back to me and said, we've been looking at clothing that we just thought was not very well made, but it could be that accommodations were made in 18th, 17th century clothing to, I hate to use the word compensate, but it's really to accommodate bodies that may have had some ability differences or scoliosis. The 18th century was, they were fashionable. Society was absolutely obsessed with straightness, as they called it. You know, you had to have really ramrod straight back and upright posture. If you didn't, and you were wealthy enough, chances are you had a very good tailor, mantua maker, dressmaker who could make those accommodations for you. And so we may actually have a lot of clothing in collections that has been made specifically to suit people who are differently abled. I found a tailor's book back in the early 1700s that actually has whole chapters on how to accommodate men with what they call sloped shoulders or misaligned, really unbalanced left to right. And they actually say in there, you know, it's the job of the tailor to make the man look good. So they're basically sort of using clothing as a way to, I will use the word disguise. There's a lot of wording that's changed over the years. And I do make that point in the book that I tend to use the wording of the time, even though that may not be acceptable anymore. I think it's important to understand that the way that we talk about stuff has changed throughout time. So yes, the tailors were hard at it from early on. They knew what they were doing. And as I said, we've lost that to a certain extent. And there's as far as working class, the real sort of destitute poor, we don't have the evidence, we don't have the data, enough data to know really what was going on. But one would imagine that they were wearing, you know, whatever they could get their hands on, basically. I would love to dig into more about not just any culture that uses wrapping and tying and pinning. I talk a tiny bit about Indigenous people in North America. There's a wonderful book that was written about the history of disability in the U.S. I quote it a lot. Her last name is Nelson, and I forget her first name now. But she talks a lot about how disability wasn't really seen in Indigenous culture, because everybody, no matter what their physical or cognitive ability was, they all had a part to play in the tribal culture. And so you have this equality, and you get a piece of fabric that's either a rectangle or an oval, and you get to wrap it around your body and pin it or tie it or both, however you want. It immediately equalizes the opportunity, right? And you're right, with tailoring, where we wanted to suddenly try and fit to the body, that increases the complexity and the difficulty.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, and especially, and going back to the corset that you mentioned earlier, talking about fitting to the body, you cannot be more on point than the corset. That was the very point of this garment. And it's also this garment that has, it's very private, but also expected in a social context in public. You know, for more than 400 years, the corset was the foundation on which Euro-American fashion was built. And I mean literally the foundation. And it is this really fascinating case study that bridges that space, as you kind of touched on briefly earlier, about fashion versus disability. Like, what was the aim of the garment? What was the purpose of the garment? I think there's like a lot of liminal space there that's really interesting. So could you tell us more about this?
I can. I would first of all refer anybody who's interested to Valerie Steele's 2001 book, The Cultural History of the Corset, which is still, I think, the best thing out there. So I can't talk a lot to it. I can just say that it is a fascinating, it has such a dualistic nature because it, as you said, it has shaped society, literally, men and women, for the last few hundred years. Well, there's even evidence. Again, I don't pretend to be an expert on ancient history. that we see in pictures. I remember that from my sort of very first lesson in fashion history. I'm like, whoa, where did that come from?
The Minoans were very chic.
they were actually the bull jumping and everything. It was very cool. So we've been sort of doing that for a long time. But the fact that it can be classed as an assistive medical device, but then also be sort of an instrument of fashion torture in a way. But then there's a whole sort of community around corseting, and it's lasted. It's still out there. If you talk to anybody, everybody has a different opinion about it. So it's absolutely fascinating. The only thing I can think of, I remember reading Graham Pullen's great book, Design Meets Disability, which is another one I would really recommend for people diving into this for the first time, about his essay on eyeglasses, which is another accessory which really is an assistive device, right? And now has become a high-end luxury need for people. You think about how much people will spend on fashion eyeglasses. So it's interesting how some of these things have really sort of crossed the boundaries and then crossed back again and continue to do that. It's really, really fascinating.
Dress listeners, whatever your reason for wanting to learn a new language, whether it's an upcoming international adventure, communicating with your friends and family abroad, or even professional purposes, Rosetta Stone has got you covered.
As the trusted expert in language learning for 30 years now, you can join millions of Rosetta Stone users to learn any of the 25 languages offered. That includes Spanish, French, Italian, German, Korean, Chinese, Japanese, Dutch, Arabic, and so many more.
And this is fast language acquisition, friends. There are no English translations, so you learn to speak, listen, and think in your new language. And right now, you can get lifetime access to all 25 of Rosetta Stone's language courses for 50% off. That's language learning for 25 languages for the rest of your life, which, Cass, is frankly amazing.
It is. And what are you waiting for, dress listeners? Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, dress listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
Dress listeners, did you know that you can save on everything from fashion to beauty, home decor to groceries, even kids' school supplies with Rakuten?
Rakuten is a shopping platform that partners with over 3,500 stores across every category. Beauty, clothing, electronics, home, department stores, pets, you name it. You're already shopping at your favorite stores, so why not be saving while doing it? It really is a no-brainer.
How does it work, you ask? Well, stores pay Rakuten a commission for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the commission with its members. You get paid via a check or PayPal quarterly.
Membership is free, and it's easy to sign up. So join the 17 million members who have already saved at their favorite brands. Start all your shopping at Rakuten.com or get the Rakuten app to start saving today. Your cash back really adds up. That's Rakuten.com. Dress listeners, are you not feeling like yourself these days? Do you suspect it might be related to some of the hormonal changes all women experience? Well, then Hormone Harmony is here for you. Hormone Harmony capsules contain science-backed herbal extracts called adaptogens. Now, here's the beauty about adaptogens. They help the body adapt to any stressors, like chaotic hormonal changes that happen naturally throughout a woman's life.
Happy Mammoth, the company that created Hormone Harmony, is dedicated to making women's lives easier. And that means using only science-backed ingredients that have been proven to work for women. They make no compromise when it comes to quality, and it shows.
So whether you find yourself in menopause, perimenopause, or simply experiencing racing thoughts and low moods, poor sleep, and feeling tired all the time, or even a low sex drive, Hormone Harmony is here to get you feeling like yourself again.
For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code DRESSED at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code DRESSED for 15% off today. So a couple of the women that you profile in the book are depicted in engravings or in photography, and they are quite obviously corseted. And this really brings up this aspect of your book that I really, really enjoyed, is that you profiled notable figures in history, and you detail their specific relationships to dress and disability. Would you tell us about a couple of the people that you profiled that you found the most compelling?
Yes, absolutely. I tried to pick one person from each century. I had not expected, first of all, I didn't know that General Tom Thumb had a wife. Her name was Lavinia Warren. As with everything with Barnum, it was all for show. But we do know that they actually went through a marriage ceremony. She was also a little person. Her sister, Minnie, also got married to a little person in Barnum's show. One has to take some of this with a grain of salt, I guess. There were pictures of her holding a baby, which was obviously not her baby, just for marketing purposes for Barnum. But he did spend a lot of money on her wardrobe. She was a customer of Charles Frederick Worth in Paris.
This literally blew my mind.
Yeah. She wrote an autobiography. After General Tom Thumb passed away, she got remarried to a count in Italy and wrote an autobiography. Now, I can't attest. I read the original, but one doesn't know if it was originally written. But again, what you have to accept some of it with a little bit of hesitation. But she talks about going to Paris for fittings. Apparently, Worth had a special dress form made up for her that he had at his studio in Paris.
And he did that actually commonly for some of his best clients. He even hired what were called saucis. Sometimes he would hire his mannequins, the live models who worked on a daily basis at the House of Worth. He would hire saucis who had the exact same measurements as his best clients. So yeah, that makes sense.
I just got done talking to a group last week saying, do your fit models look like your customers?
Exactly.
Well, I still don't know if we're doing that properly. And then I believe, again, I mentioned it in the book, I think it's the City Museum of New York has a dress form of hers, an original one. We know she was a sewist. There's a sewing machine that was given to her that's in the collection of the Smithsonian. She made her clothes quite early on in her childhood before she even was plucked out of her house by Barnum and put in the circus, basically. But the Barnum Museum in Connecticut has a lot of information about her. And the wedding was all over the newspapers, as weddings, big weddings were in those days. But think on the scale of like the Vanderbilt wedding or the Carnegie wedding or any of those older Dutch families in New York that in the latter part of the century were getting married off to rich English lords with no money. It was that kind of scale. It was amazing. Her trousseau and everything. So I was delighted to read about her. And I think the lovely thing is that there's barely any mention of her. This is Lavinia Warren, Mrs. Tom Thumb, and she wears fashions by Madame Demarest and Charles Frederick Worth. Now, I think one has to then contextualize it. It's like everybody knew that they were part of Barnum's production. So it may be that that didn't need to be said a second time. But I'll leave that at that.
Yeah. I want to write something about her. I want to dig into this further.
I was doing that. As with any historical research, you know, you start somewhere and then you've got all these tentacles that sort of come up and hit you from behind. So the other woman, the 20th century icon I picked, obviously, was Frida Kahlo. I say obviously, I shouldn't say that. Nothing's obvious, but she was a powerhouse and continues to be. I mean, her influence, I can't imagine how many images of Frida are out there globally. And she means so many different things to so many different people. I picked her because I feel like, even though I've spoken to a lot of people and there's been movies, a lot of people don't understand how much she did suffer physically throughout her life. It wasn't just, well, she had polio as a kid. Then she had this bus accident. And there's actually a professor at NC State who's written a book called Letters to Mama. So I was able to go back and find that book. And actually, he translated all these letters she wrote to her mother. Just the suffering that she went through, the amount of operation she had to have, and still pushed on and made a name for herself as an artist, which was her prime. You know, she didn't want to be a disabled artist. She was an artist. And she was an amazing photographic model as well. I mean, she was iconic, really iconic. She knew how to pose for the camera. She was very, very, I use the Scots word, canny about what she was doing. And then you've got this other layering of, we go back to Indigenous costume again, right? She wore the costume of her mother's Tehuana community because it was really simple. It was a square piece of fabric folded over and stitched down the side seams. And then to make it, you know, it was the fabrication and the print and the embroidery that made it interesting. And she had many, many of those. Worn with the huipil, which is the long skirt, and then sometimes the rebojo over the top, which is the shawl. But basically, she wore the two pieces so that the doctors could lift it up and get into her back, and because of the multiple surgeries she had on her back. But she was wearing it. She always wore a costume. She was dressing up since she was a little girl, playing with identity. Her grandmother apparently collected a lot of couture, and she inherited all of her grandmother's couture clothing and absolutely loved French couture as well. So this idea of, I guess, distinction or expression was very much part of who she was and an artist. And I one other thing, the corset that she wore.
Her paintings. I think a lot of times when you see those paintings, people don't exactly realize what's going on there. But it is in more than one of her artworks that she depicts herself, her self-portrait, her wearing her, in this case, not necessarily a fashion corset, but an assistive corset.
And she gives the corset, I mean, you were talking earlier about the corset, but she gives it another, it's almost like it's another human being in a way. It's an entity that's taking on a force of life itself. And that's, she lived with it. For most of her life, she was wearing this corset. And so it became a sort of almost like an alter ego. Mm-hmm. You can see that things.
Yeah. You know, something else, because I think a lot of people don't, as you said, don't realize that a lot of times her fashions were disguising that fact. But one of the things that I found super interesting about your book is that I had never really considered that during times of war, the public perception of people with physical disabilities shifted. How so, and what role did dress play in that?
Gosh, there's so much in this. I mean, we could write another book on this. So first of all, I'll talk to war generally. As heinous it is, it has also been a time of invention and creativity, mostly because quite often scarcity will unleash the creative in most of us. And that's certainly true for prolonged periods of societal scarcity. I'm sure it's happening now in parts of the world that we're seeing on the TV every day, unfortunately. So on a societal level, what at least the Second World War did was to put disabled people into the workplace. And that's literally a question of numbers. Like, there weren't enough people without disabilities, so most of them were dispatched off to the front. And, you know, it's like it did the same thing for women, women's rights. There's a reason that most of the votes for women in the Western world around about 1919, 1920, 1921, right? Because finally women were able to get into the workplace and stay there and prove that they were able to do these jobs. There was actually a push in the US, at least in the Second World War, to bring people with disabilities into the workplace. And so that actually, again, as awful as war is, it actually provided an opportunity just from sheer numbers game that we needed to get people in the workplace. And that will feed into the functional fashions movement, which I think we're going to talk about in a minute. As far as perceptions go, that's a really difficult one, because I talk a little bit about how the Civil War in this country was interesting, because photography was a new thing. There was a lot of photographs taken, and soldiers did not want to play down their disability. They wanted to be shown that they had given a limb, I'm air quoting here, in the cause, whether it was North or South, it didn't matter. And people were extremely accepting of that visual cue as they were walking down the street or were being pushed in a wheelchair down the street. It was sort of a, I don't want to say a badge of honor, but it was like that kind of communication to people that they had been wounded. And so the respect. Now, I think of stories I've heard from people in Vietnam, and the military uniform now is a little bit of a contentious thing, I think, depending on where you are. So, you know, we've adopted camouflage. Anyway, I'm not going to get into that. There's a whole nother area. One other thing, you mentioned something about, well, I was saying about military. Two of the people that I talk about in the 19th century, Lord Nelson, he designed his own hat and a sun visor, which we've got the original sketches from Lock the Hatter in London. I think that's delightful. And then Lord Raglan, who gave us the Raglan sleeve.
I had no idea. Again, another aha moment I had reading your book. So that term comes from his disability. He had some movement issues with his arm, right? And so he needed a little more allowance, a little more forgiveness. And that's how we get that kind of ample sleeve construction.
Yeah, I'd love to know. I'm more on the technical side of design myself. And so everything that I found, I was thinking, well, how did they do that? And I did contact Aquascutum in London. And I don't think that they have archives about that. I didn't make any headway. So if anybody out there knows anyone who knows the history of Aquascutum, I've done everything I can do, but I'd love to know more about technically why it was designed that way, because we still don't know the why. That simple idea of taking the sleeve seam from the underarm up to the neck instead of wrapping it around the shoulder for a typical set-in sleeve, why they felt that would do, why they would give more movement. I haven't found that yet. Love to know that.
I mean, there's always more research to be done. We say this on Dressed all the time. It's like everybody's always standing on everybody's shoulders with research that came before them. And actually, you know, I my background is an art historian as well. And that's one of the reasons why I got so fascinated with the study of fashion history, is because so much has already been tackled within art history that you have to specialize on one artist and build your entire career on that. And, you know, our field of study currently is still wide open, and there's all these really interesting things and different paths to go down as a researcher. So we were just talking about World War I, and this is, of course, one of these periods that changes the representation of disabled people in the public sphere, but so also did polio. And you note in your work that this, quote, gave rise in managed care of disabled persons from institutionalization to rehabilitation, end quote. So could you speak to this cultural shift that happens? Because what really happens moving forward is it starts to birth these inquiries and these studies focusing on the clothing needs of those with disabilities.
It's about the perception of disability is so much bigger than just the clothing aspect. And I think to understand where the shift came from is that prior to the First World War, again, I'm capturing this in a very westernized manner, because I haven't written globally, because that just would be too much for this book. But hiding disability away and hiding people who were not visibly acceptable in the 19th century was very important. So institutionalization was the norm. Let's get people off the streets because they don't look like the rest of us, or even the ugly laws that I mentioned. And these were laws in this country that would fine people who were kind of destitute, poor, and disabled just because they didn't want them on the street. There were laws against, as I said, looking ugly, looking. So institutions, there's a whole topic that's out there on institutional uniforms. We know that that has been used in incarceration, which is still an institution. It changes quite a bit still as to how to define someone in an institution. But it was more to do with, again, a visual cue that someone was an institutionalized person rather than, can this clothing actually help someone? Somewhere along the line, we change, and there was a lot of writing about it in the late 19th century, a lot of people, activists for social justice and equality, writing about, well, hang on, let's just not sort of put these people in the building and throw away the key. There can be rehabilitation. And a lot of it was very much tied in with religious groups. But this idea came about that, first of all, that people could be rehabilitated into society. And that was a good thing, that we could have an inclusive society. And secondly, in the 1920s, 1930s, clothing is a way, the act of getting dressed and undressed is a way to help. And this was specifically for children with polio. Is a way to help them get more integrated back into society. It trained them to become more independent. And so, you know, when we look at what we call the activities of daily living today, which is still one of the measures as to how disabled you are, for lack of a better way of putting it, dressy of daily living. So shopping, two things that are very relative to clothing. So it is a measure. And so clothing became a measure to a certain extent. What I love about this is that, you know, so how can clothing, not only the act of wearing something can, once you have it on, can really transform you, can transform the way you feel, can transform the way you present yourself to somebody else and change their ideas, but also the success that you have or lack of success in actually physically putting garments on and taking them off can actually contribute to your well-being as well.
I think for people that do not have a disability, you understand that impact in your day-to-day life. When you feel really good about what you're wearing, your whole attitude shifts. So I'm sure our listeners can readily identify with that concept.
And I just want to mention one more thing. When I was doing the research for my dissertation 25 years ago, one of the women I worked with, it took her an hour and a half to get dressed in the morning, and then she would have to rest for 45 minutes. So something that we do, that many of us do in 10, 15 minutes, can take a large part of someone's morning. That still sticks with me. How little I understood about people's lived experience.
Kate, thank you so much for sharing a bit about your research and your wonderful book. Dress listeners, we will pause our conversation with Kate here today, but she will be back on Friday with more to say as we have barely scratched the surface of the subject of dressing for disability.
And on Friday, we wander into some really interesting territory to chat about some of the very well-known mid-century American fashion editors and designers who took up the cause of creating functional fashions, as they were called at this time, in the belief that design inherently holds the power to solve problems. So we're going to hear more about that on Friday. And until then, that does it for us today. May you consider the functionality of your clothing next time you get dressed.
Dress listeners, my next class, What Women Wore to the Revolution, Part 2, is now open for registration at dresshistory.com. Beginning June 23rd, we will explore the evolution and revolution of women's fashion across some of the most iconic eras in fashion history, 1930s, 40s, 50s, and 60s. So I really hope you will join me for that. And of course, dresshistory.com is our website where you can find lots more information on our upcoming classes, trips, tours, including our fall 2024 fashion history trip to Paris. Our initial week is sold out, but there is a waiting list for the second trip. If we get enough people, we will add that second week, October 12th through the 19th. If you would like to register your interest for this second iteration of the trip, you can just send us an email at hello@dressedhistory.com.
You can also head over to our website to learn more about my fashion history tours in the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City. Offered every Friday right now, I will soon be expanding these offerings in the next couple weeks or so. So stay tuned. Remember, we love hearing from you. So if you'd like to write to us, you can do so at hello@dressedhistory.com. You can also DM us on Instagram @dressed_podcast, which is where we post images and reels accompany each week's episodes. If you would like to search the Instagram content for this week's episodes, you can search the hashtags dressed366 and dressed367. That's #dressed366 and #dressed367. Thank you always for your support, and more Dressed coming your way on Friday.
Dressed, the History of Fashion, is a production of Dressed Media.
During the summer, I love to keep Fiji water on hand to keep me and my family hydrated and refreshed. It really is sourced from the islands of Fiji. Drop by drop, Fiji water collects in a sustainable ancient aquifer 1,600 miles away from the nearest continent, protected and preserved naturally from external elements. As the water filters through volcanic rock, it collects a unique profile of electrolytes and minerals, resulting in more than double the electrolytes as the other two top premium water bottle brands, giving Fiji water its soft, smooth taste. Unlike some other premium bottled waters, Fiji water's electrolytes are 100% naturally occurring, and this water even has a perfectly balanced pH of 7.7. Fiji water really is Earth's finest water, and since 2022, its 330-milliliter and 500-milliliter bottles have been produced in 100% recycled plastic, so you can feel proud of your choice in bottled water. Get stocked up on Fiji water this summer and visit your local retailer to pick some up today for your next backyard party, beach or pool day, hike, or even your home office. It's not just water, it's Fiji water.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.